Hello, everybody. I'm Paul Giger. Welcome inside the MTOM studio podcast room. Yeah, it's a studio. We do a podcast, which is also on audio and video, which was an interesting debate internally here at Iowa PBS, which is where this is produced. We're going to talk a little bit about production today, the behind the scenes of a film, a documentary done in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Henceforth, my usual plaid fits in, as we discuss, with the, let's see, he is the writer, producer, and editor of The Humongous Fungus Among Us. It's a new, well, that's the fun joke that my old biology teacher used to say, but it's The Humongous Fungus. We're going to be talking about a project that is a life project for Tim Warmonen. He grew up in Crystal Falls, Michigan, which is the site of this film and the site of this story. So we're going to talk about how the film came about, a little bit about Tim and his career, and how this project has been a lifelong for three gentlemen, as well as Tim and his crew, how they all met, how they are profiling both the scientific find in the rural areas of Michigan, and how it ended up from idea to being shown at film festivals and maybe on PBS stations, more than just one that it's already been on. So this is a little inside baseball of television, but I think it's an interesting story that you're going to enjoy. Okay, Tim, so I was looking, normally I wear the gray for these interviews, but I really wanted to wear the flannel plaid because we're talking about the UP. We'll get into the look of the lumberjack of being a youper. You're kind of dressed that same way, but let's be honest, you're in the Chicago area. So tell me what your day job is.
Yeah, my day job is I primarily edit commercials. I do voiceovers, you know, whenever the opportunity kind of arises. But one of my favorite things that I've ever done is to work on passion projects, which are in the, you know, documentaries and things that tell a story in a different way.
Passion project. I see it all the time, you know, online where someone will say, you know, do something you love. You never have to work a day in your life. Do you feel that that's true?
Yeah. I mean, my current project, I started back in 2013. You know, I started researching the idea and we shot in 2017, 2018. And then I basically was editing it throughout that whole process once we actually had some footage to put together. But yeah, it's just a joy. I mean, every moment that I worked on it or changed it or tried to make it a little bit better or, you know, worked with my team, Logan and Lori on it, talked to the scientists, like, what do you guys think? Like, it was just, it's a whole, we weren't trying to sell anything, you know, we were just trying to actually just tell like a really interesting story from where I happen to have grown up as well.
Well, that gets to the whole, you're talking about commercials, you know, you're trying to sell something, but don't you think though, in a film, you're trying to still sell something? I mean, you're kind of trying to sell a story to people.
Yeah. And I think I guess I'm trying to convince that this is a reason like to exist, you know, that we made this because we feel like it's an important thing of information that should be out in the world. And, you know, it's an inspirational story as well, but it's kind of like there were so many parts that weren't known by a lot of people that I talked to. And I always just wanted to find out to kind of have an opportunity to compile a particular moment in time, you know, took years to do, but I think now like that will always exist and people can look at that and hopefully, yeah, we never had any intention of like making money from this, but, you know, getting it out there, doing film festival circuits has been just incredible. It's been amazing.
Well, let's disclose a couple of things here. I knew your older brother at Wartburg College. Last week's guest on the podcast was an old high school classmate. I pointed like right there. Jen was from up there. We also went to Wartburg. But why did you go to Wartburg, you know, leave Michigan to come to this small school in Northeast Iowa?
You know, I guess I went to Wartburg. So exactly. So my brother went there both of my cousins went there, my mom, my aunt and uncle. I think that's pretty, I feel like my, there's going to be a couple more on some part of our family who are kind of getting to that age. I came up there because I loved the community. I had visited a number of times when my brother was at Wartburg. I remember him and doing castle capers and things like that. And I also went to a broadcasting camp the year before I graduated from high school. And I kind of felt like this was a place where, you know, I intended to be a journalism major. And it was just a place that I could just, you know, get my foot in the door quickly and, you know, try and do a lot of maybe things that I couldn't do at a bigger school. When I was a sophomore at Wartburg, I was able to work on my own movie kind of with a bunch of people who were in the theater department that I was also in and play it in the theater in town. Like, and I did it again in my May term. So actually I did it my May term as an independent study. And then I did it again when I was a junior and then played my second movie. So it's kind of, it was just a place that I felt it, there were a lot of opportunities if you went out to grab it.
So filmmaking, so journalism, the intent. So it sounds like filmmaking kind of bit you and you just couldn't shake it. But then commercial world and paying bills kind of took over.
Yeah. I mean, I'd say the commercial world, I did two internships in Chicago when I was at Wartburg. And that's where I realized that I was really probably most excited about editing, about post-production. So I entered at two different businesses who primarily did commercial work, but there was some like History Channel work that they did kind of on the side. You know, I think that is what really, and you know, they're, even though they're commercials, I mean, they're still like stories, right? Just the process of putting these things together with really talented individuals who are all trying to make something the best they can be. And a positive is that I kind of got myself into comedy commercials more than anything else. So at least we all had a good laugh while doing it, right? You try and make something memorable.
Well, and you're trying to tell a story in a short amount of time. And that is
30 seconds.
30 seconds. And whether, or 60 seconds or 90 seconds, if you went into journalism in television, sometimes in public TV, we get, you know, we might get 2 minutes, 6 minutes, maybe a whole half hour to tell a story. Sometimes it gets drawn out, but there's always a lot to put out there. And I always have a list of things that I always want to work on. And it sounds like you're kind of the same way. You have this home area and you knew about this thing that you wanted to tell. Did you want to tell the story of Crystal Falls right away when you graduated college, or did you want a little bit of experience before you came and tackled what you knew was going to be a big project?
You know, I'd say it wasn't even an idea until the amount of times that I told my clients that I was from this small town with this huge mushroom. And they all said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "Well, we have Fungus Fest every year. And there's this massive mushroom that at one time it was known as being among the world's largest old and living creatures." And so they kept on asking me, and I wore my humongous fungus shirt to work because, you know, in advertising, there's not really a dress code. And so that's sort of what maybe in 2013, I had a little bit of downtime once I got promoted to an editor. You have a little bit, your schedules are a little bit different. And I just started researching it. So that's kind of where it really began. Since I was 11 years old, there was a humongous fungus fest in Crystal Falls, Michigan. And I always wondered what it was, but it was the initiative to actually take the next steps and to realize that through those years working in advertising, I kind of made a lot of connections for people who might like to do it as a passion project as well. And that's really where kind of things got rolling.
They would want to do the crew side of things. Maybe they didn't have the tie to, did they have, or did they have a tie to Crystal Falls?
Okay. No, I mean, at an industry event, I talked to one of my friends, but he worked at actually a competing editing company. And he said, what are you up to these days? And I said, well, I'm kind of working on this treatment for this documentary. And I told him, what the, you know, what my general idea was, who I'd like to interview. And he was just all on board. And he's like, well, let's just go shoot it. Let's go do it. I've got nice 4K cameras. He had connections to sound guys. And so I kind of shared my treatment and my outline with him. And then we sort of, I had a producer friend who I got interested in, Lori as well. You know, and it kind of takes a lot of people. Like I said, we're not doing this for the money. Like, we're doing it because we're actually just, you know, passionate about telling this story.
But the drive from Chicago to Crystal Falls, I'm guessing, is somewhere between 5 and 6 hours across the state of Wisconsin to the UP.
Correct.
So it's not like it was in the backyard where you could just hop up there for a day. You have to come in.
No, we did. I mean, and even our first shoot, when we reached out to Dr. Johan Brun, and he was the person who discovered the fungus back in 1992, we reached out to him and he said, oh yeah, come on down to Missouri where I live and stay at my house for a weekend. So suddenly the three of us and the sound guy, Ed, we all just packed a bunch of gear into the car and spent a whole weekend interviewing Johan. And that was just the first round of shoots. But, you know, it takes a certain type of person too, who is excited about the process as much as Logan and Lori are, as am I. So it was actually more of just, it was a fun, you know, it was, we knew what we hoped to get after doing all these interviews and putting everything together, but just the process was just a blast.
So research is a key part before you, I mean, yes, you packed camera gear, but you have to, there's a whole lot of stuff that happens before you, you know, the big reveal or whatever it is that you're trying to get to in a film.
Right. And I didn't know much about mushrooms at all. And so I am asking the majority of the questions in the documentary. So, I mean, I needed to make myself a little more knowledgeable about, you know, how, you know, what to ask Johan. He's the professional. And, you know, when we sat down with him, when I had pages upon pages of questions that then you know, ask a question, then you'll change your, you know, next question based on kind of what he says. And we sat down with him and we talked for 2 hours without stopping. And I was like, we got to roll the cameras. We weren't even recording yet. And so when we officially got the lights and everything set up, I talked to Johan and learned so much in about 5 hours. We had our first interview was, you know, under the heat of the lights.
Well, you're finding Johan had a passion, like you have a passion for making a film. And when you have a passion, it's easy to talk for a long time about it. And you'll tell anybody that'll have a listening ear.
That's true. That's true. He and Jim and Myron have gone back to the site year after year after year to learn more about this particular individual that's, you know, under the forest in the UP of Michigan.
So is it a scientific, is the hook of this scientific, or is the hook of this project something else?
So I would say that the film it's primarily a scientific film, but with the addition of the community aspect of Crystal Falls and how they responded to this international news story and how they celebrated every year by having a humongous fungus fest. And then I think just kind of, I think it all comes down to connection as well. So that's one theme that you can see, that this has all been a positive thing for the community. It's been positive for the three scientists because they kind of, some of them changed careers or changed places where they were professors at because of this discovery. And, you know, in a lot of ways it put the UP on the map because people wouldn't necessarily know where the Upper Peninsula of Michigan is. And Johnny Carson's talking about the fungus. Like it became, yeah, worldwide news. So I think the theme of the documentary is science, the wonders of nature, and the connections that it can bring to a community.
Well, so many small communities, the one I grew up in, it's called Farmers Day. What are we surrounded by? Farmers. The town I live in now, the community festival used to be called Feed and Seed because we produced feed and seed here. So many towns hook their festivals around whether it's Strawberry Fest or Rhubarb Fest. Why not a Fungus Fest, right?
Exactly. And I'd say just one of the... question, one of the answers we got in the documentary, he said just like that, he said it's all about discoverability. Like, what makes your town unique? Why should people come to visit?
Well, is and that's in your trailer, and that has stuck with me a little bit because it sounds like everybody feels like they have to, we're back to you, what we were talking about, what you do. You're trying to sell something in a short amount of time. They're trying to sell their community. We're all trying to sell a certain thing of you need to come to Crystal Falls because of this, or you need to come to LeClaire, Iowa because of Tugfest. We're all selling something. We're really good at it in the United States. This is what they're selling.
That's true. And, you know, it seems like I was paid by Crystal Falls to make this, you know, but that's not the case. They didn't know I was putting this together with a team at all. But I think that's a really cool thing that now we're going to play it again during Fungus Fest this year. And it's a way that people even coming into town can watch this maybe in the theater during Fungus Fest and know what everybody is celebrating that wasn't explained in the past.
So these three scientists, how does one discover from Missouri to, I mean, I understand that professors go on trips and they identify regions that they want to study, or they think something might be in these woods. How did Johan make the connection to even go to the UP?
So Johan used to be a professor at Michigan Tech University out of Houghton, Michigan. And he was actually hired via the university by the U.S. Navy, actually, because they were conducting experiments over this new mode of communication. This is where it kind of gets left field, by the way. So this is true, though.
That's all right. We can always hit rewind on a podcast in case you didn't. Yeah. Let me hear that again. Right. I do it all the time.
So in the 80s, the U.S. Navy was trying to create a system to communicate with submarines in the ocean without having them come up to the top and basically ruin the fact, you know, that they're a submarine and all the benefits of being a submarine. So there was this system where antennas were put into the ground and a signal could be sent through the bedrock all the way out into the ocean, like an extremely low frequency. So it's called the ELF system, ELF. So extremely low frequency would basically be able to say, come up or don't come up. And that's all. It would be a very simple message. So Johan worked on the species called Armillaria, which is the fungus that we're discussing. And they wanted to see if there were effects on the, you know, on plants and animals. And that was one of them that he was in charge of checking on the effects of. Like, would this extremely low frequency affect, would it kill off these species, right? So that's kind of because there was actually a pretty big uproar in the community that this is bad, like this isn't a good thing. It's not in service. It actually never ended up being in service, actually, but Johan did say that the studies proved like it was nothing really affected because of this extremely low frequency. But he found, so he had already been studying that type of mushroom, that type of fungus. But as he was trying to delineate the different individuals, he was kind of confused that it seemed like there was one individual here and normally there wouldn't be another individual kind of on top of it because they kind of have territories. And so that's why it was right around the time that DNA testing began. So he got connected with Jim and Myron in Canada from a conference that they were at. And they actually were really into the genetics of specifically mushroom and fungi. So they were able to help him figure out which ones of these individuals, you know, what types of species they are and where were they. And when they did that, they were like, this is really strange. Like, this one has the same DNA and it's going out this far. And like, why is it going out much further than we expected? And that opened up the door to like that. They said this species of fungus is among the world's largest and oldest individuals that had been found up to that point. Right. So it's pretty wild that they just hit that exact juncture when these big gels of DNA tests in the late 80s, early 90s came about.
You resisted, but I can't any longer. I have to cite what my high school biology teacher used to always say, that there is a fungus among us. And that's kind of how what they talk about. And that's also a big part of this.
For sure. And the how important actually fungus is for the entire ecosystem. I mean, fungi is a completely different kingdom, you know, from plants and animals. It's a whole separate thing that we're still learning. You know, the professionals are learning far more about than we knew in the past, and how this particular species, Armillaria gallica, which is the one we discuss in the film, what it does is it will basically kind of finish off dying trees, but then its important role in the ecosystem is that it will recycle the nutrients basically back into the soil. So that's what it eats. And it will put those nutrients back in the soil and get rid of all the waste matter in the process, and then which allows more plants to grow and more trees to grow. I mean, it's part of the circle of life, right?
It erodes. It does what, say, an acid does. It eats mm-hmm. away at things, but it's a natural way, yep. right? Is that the way I get you?
Yeah, right. And it's a species trying to survive, just like we're a species trying to survive. And it all begins, right? I mean, it all began from two spores landed at one opportune place, fused. So two 10 microns of a meter spores fused at this point, and then started growing out 8 inches a year. And then they believe, you know, it could be up to 2,500 years old.
And it's only, and so it shows how small it is. This area is how many square miles where this fungus is? It's not very many, right?
So where the individual they think is now, so they originally thought it was about 38 acres is what they estimated back in 1992.
Which is basically that green piece of land right behind me, yes.
There you go. That's a great reference. Exactly. But they didn't go out there intending to find – they didn't go out there to say, well, can I find the world's largest and oldest living organism? That wasn't their purpose. They actually published the paper to say this DNA technique can help you delineate what an individual is. And it's something that didn't really exist back at that point. So as the years went on, you'll see in the documentary that they continued to study it and to find out what else there is to learn about, like, why does it so rarely mutate? Like, what can we learn from that? How big roughly is it now? You know, because they realized they didn't actually get to the boundary.
And I've seen some maps as it does get larger. So is there the possibility of taking this fungus, digging it up, and transplanting it somewhere else, or it could accidentally be taken somewhere else and cause some type of new location for this fungus?
Yeah, well, it would have to – the dream of Jim Anderson specifically, he said, if I just had 5 minutes and the soil became transparent, like I could do all this research, like years and years of research I could do in 5 minutes. If they were to pull all these tendrils out, like it's tons, at least 100 tons of weight. Like it's just massive. So the amount of like displacement that would happen, right, with the soil, because I think it goes down about 4 feet roughly. But here's the other twist. I mean, this isn't the only one. This is just part of our planet's ecosystem. There are loads of species that are similar to it that are doing kind of similar things, like the one in Oregon, which is Armillaria stoiae.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up. So there's one like it in Oregon, and that one's devastating to trees and other plant life.
It is, you know, and it might be, it's an interesting thing because is it better at what it does? Or, you know, a species, if they're trying to, like, they don't want to kill its host, you know? So it's going through trees, healthy trees, a lot faster, and can be devastating to the point of, for foresters, for sure. You know, early on, this isn't something in the documentary, but I asked in my, you know, elementary style questioning in some cases.
Welcome to the club. That's what I do. Yeah, keep going. I get you.
I asked if you could compare the two as dinosaurs.
Oh, okay.
Right? Right. And he said, I mean, it's not a direct comparison, obviously, but, you know, he said Armillaria gallica in the UP is a little more benevolent. It's a little more like a, you know, brachiosaur, right? And in the case of, like, how fast it eats and things like that. And then, you know, he said the one in Oregon is a little more like a T-Rex. It's a little more, it'll rip apart things quickly and don't have a chance to grow back as fast. So it has a less of a symbiosis with its environment, I would say.
Okay. We could talk science all day, I'm sure. I would not be as apt to keep up with you here, Tim. I want to go back to the community of Crystal Falls and how mm-hmm. they've embraced this, and people come from around. You said that there were many different stories that have been written about National. You talk about Johnny Carson. How much other research could you tap into on stories that had been done and told about A, this region, and B, this fungus that you could pull from?
Well, I'd say one just incredible source was the 25-year-old box that Johan had in storage that he literally hadn't opened for 25 years, and he did it for us in front of the camera. So as he's pulling items out, like, he's remembering, you know, from years prior. So a lot of the newspaper articles that we have, there's a Wisconsin Public Television clip that he had, an old VHS tape, right? So we recorded a lot of those that he pulled out of there. He had a lot of the original shirts, which I was the shirt that I grew up with. And then from there, you know, as I was editing the entire project, I just had to keep on looking. I had to keep on looking for more material that I could come across. Like, there was an Unsolved Mysteries clip that I came across, that was about ELF, which I was just amazed that actually, Robert Stack mentioned.
I was just going to say, I was going to do a Robert Stack impersonation, but we don't have to. You can right. just imagine it. And so the fungus came across and was the yeah. elf sent out its signal and was received on the other side of the lake. But who was right. there? Sorry.
Right, right. I know, exactly. So that when you're building a story where there are a lot of talking heads, right, a lot of talking heads interviews, you have to find as much B-roll, and to make it, you know, like I said earlier, I wanted to make it a comprehensive story that you could look to. And here's a lot of the things that people kind of said, like, oh, did you hear it was on Johnny Carson? And like, well, I got to get it in there. Right.
So you had to go to Nebraska into the vault or wherever the Carson vault is.
Right. Right.
So you mentioned public TV. This became a film that then was shown on one of the public TV stations in Michigan.
It was, which was amazing because it was my hometown PBS. I used to watch, you know, all the shows on PBS when I was growing up. So it was extra special that I got to share it with the Crystal Falls community and the Upper Peninsula with the reach of that station, because they've known about this and have hopefully had as much interest in just checking it out as I had. Putting it together. But, you know, there was that. We played it at the Fresh Coast Film Festival in Marquette, Michigan.
Which is what, maybe 60, 70 miles away?
Yeah, yeah. It's about an hour and a half.
Okay, a little longer. Okay.
But, I mean, that opening night I played, so in October at Fresh Coast, they said, oh, we're going to play it like it'll be the one feature on opening night. And it was actually the free night, which was great because there were loads more people there. And I think it was 600 people were all watching it kind of in this outdoor tent, and really, really cool. And, you know, getting it in being sort of science based, we were fortunate to have it play at the Environmental Film Festival at Yale University. I haven't said this, but recently we heard that it's going to play at the Princeton Environmental Film Festival next month. And then we played in Doc, Utah, which was so much fun because Logan, who was coming from LA, I was coming from Chicagoland. We got to meet there for that screening and do Q&As, and it was really, really a great experience because that was in an actual movie theater as well. And, you know, we gave them a really high resolution copy of the film, and yeah, it's been a great journey.
Well, I don't have a definite plan for Iowa PBS, but I know that other stations are looking at it. That has to be exciting too, that you're making it out of film festivals and onto broadcast television, wherever it hopefully works out.
Definitely. And, you know, it was on my computer. I've been working on it for 5 years. So
hopefully
you got a couple, we can get it out.
Yeah. Hopefully a couple of copies here and there just to, as an in case, right?
Oh, right, right. Definitely, definitely.
Okay, we've kind of danced around one thing that I want to finish with here, Tim. And, well, maybe not. Do you want to save the big reveal about this whole fungus? That you just, somebody wants to go see it. Can they?
Yeah. Interesting. I'll caveat that with something. I went out there in the winter and I looked around, and I have a video of me before I shot any of this documentary, and I came across these little tendrils, and I was like, I think this is it. And I'm talking to myself on my phone recording it's like as Blair Witch as it could be, you know? and then I sent the image to Johan. I was like, is this the fungus? And he said, no. So I think there's a good chance you could go out there. There's a chance you could find it, but there's a lot more of a chance that you're finding something else. And you're not going to go out there. Unfortunately, you're not going to see a giant mushroom like billowing in the woods. It's 99% this underground netting, basically. And then in 2 weeks during the year, it will sprout up small mushrooms, but actually when it sprouts up those mushrooms and join with another spore, it would actually create a different individual. So all the growth, yeah, it's like the tip of the iceberg, really. We're just seeing a tiny, tiny bit. And, you know, it comes down to Jim and Johan and Myron, who they go out there and they collect samples and then have to do DNA tests on them to even figure out if that's the one.
Right. They're digging it up and they don't really know what they're doing.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, and that's both frustrating and fascinating all at the same time. And when you say tip of the iceberg, again, I'll refer to the home farm behind me here. I'm sure it's more on this side. There's a rock out there that we never were able to get to we couldn't even see the sides of it, but it was there. And we knew that it was just the tip of this monster boulder. And that's what it's like, to put it into a different perspective of what the top of this soil is. There's so much more underneath that we just don't know, and we don't know how big it truly is.
Exactly. And I think that's a good analogy too, just for we're on the surface of this planet. We're walking around up here, but there's lots of stuff going on underground or in the oceans that we don't know that much about. So I think there's an important other message. Just it's the wonders of nature and the hidden things out there that there's a lot to learn and a lot to be amazed by.
What's next? More science or more, you know, do you have something else in mind?
Yeah, I've been researching some things actually. So nothing I can really say yet, but definitely I'm looking for that. I'm looking for that next project that I can really be excited about, knowing that they take years. but it's just, I continue to do my day job. I continue to enjoy editing various commercials. Like I just did like a holiday Nintendo spot, you know, that was a lot of fun, but, on the side, just really using a different part of my brain and just, I think, looking at the world in different ways and what kind of story could I help, you know, be a positive influence in our world as well.
Did you have a Super Bowl commercial this year?
I didn't have one this year.
But you've been a part of one before, right?
Right. So there was a Discover Card commercial in 2015 that I edited, but I was also the voice of. So I'm the voice on the end, which has been amazing. So I was on Discover Card spots for, I'm still on some online, but that have run for 10 years. I was really fortunate to get on that campaign, which is, you know, in a little, in some ways, this documentary is brought to you by Discover, but that's they don't know that they're brought to you by Discover, but they were a big help.
Well, they certainly helped the bank account, which allowed you to do those types of things.
Exactly.
Tim Warman, and thank you so very much for the time. Great to hear about some of these ins and outs and dive deep. And I know it wasn't 30 seconds. We'll settle for 30 minutes. How about that?
Sounds great. Thanks for having me.
My thanks to Tim Warman. And I'm not sure if I never did ask if he ran and was ever Mr. Fungi. Good question. If you have feedback for me or the podcast, send me a note at markettomarket@iowapbs.org. Thank you so very much for consuming this content. We'll see you next time.